1550 or fight. Martin Luther King, back in the mid-60s, suggested a $2 wage in 1968. That would be pretty close to 1550 now. It'd be over 14 in any case, however you calculate it. Can you believe that? 1550. And that's because we need the 8-hour day. It's not even the 19th century. And we need the 8-hour day. And what does the 8-hour day mean? The 8-hour day means that one member of the family, one, can go to work, collect enough money to bring home. Everyone else does their thing, whatever it is. And that's all you need to get by. It's not that you get rich. It's not that you get comfortably wealthy on your 8 hours at a living wage. No, but you make enough. And that also means, of course, that when you get to reproductive age and you're raising a baby or two, well, you don't have to abandon your babies and go out and make money. The 8-hour day has everything to do with a sufficient wage. And we haven't had that. And Americans have gotten used to working several less than 8-hour shifts per week, or even a couple of shifts per day, and not getting enough to live on, spending their whole life overworking. We fought in 1896. There was a fight, I mean, with pistols in Haymarket Square for an 8-hour day. And why is that? Because that's a basic human right in the context of a wealthy society. There is far more than enough. I could give the figures, the trillions and the billions and the billionaires. You know, we're going to have trillionaires before too long, the way things are going. There's plenty of money for everyone to get a living wage, and that's not having some sort of Soviet-style beggaring of everyone. Now, that was an entirely different context. Those gray days are past. We've really, really got the money for everyone to be prosperous. And the fact that we're not is because we won't look at the way we have maldistributed wealth in the first place. So I invite your calls on that topic, 1550 or fight. 8-hour day. You work 8 hours, got enough to pay all your bills, support your family, live decently. No one else has to work. 8-hour day, 1550 or fight. Don't we deserve that? Why are we supporting robber barons again? Didn't we learn from the first time around with robber barons? Time is 9:08. Number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Now, I've talked previously on the show about how billionaires suck the money out of your pocket. And people are more or less familiar with some of the really big recent ways. For example, the way John Paulson tanked. He bought up mortgages across the country, intending to destroy the market for those mortgages and to bet against their prices. And he became a billionaire that way, and he's still very popular as a brilliant billionaire. When you look at billionaires carefully, you don't see brilliant people. What you see is ruthless bullies. Let's look at a few. There was an article on Alternet about billionaires titled Meet the Billionaires Using Their Immense Wealth to Make Life Miserable for Ordinary Americans. Five Examples of Billionaires Pushing a Right-Wing Economic Agenda. And they start with it's by Dave Johnson. And he says, here's how it works these days. You start hearing about a big national problem, and then it becomes a drumbeat. First, there are a few articles and columns mentioning that such and such is a problem. Then a number of articles appear somehow. Then a study from a think tank confirms the problem and sounds the alarm about how terrible it is. And then just as the issue seems to be the only thing you're hearing about, a solution is presented. Of course, the solution always involves taking away something from you and giving it to some company or industry standing in front of a billionaire or three. The right question to start asking when you hear about these problems is, which billionaire is driving this? Again, this is Dave Johnson's writing in Alternet. He says, here are 5+ examples of billionaires who use their money to try to get us to think they want us to. How they want us to think. in order to enact a right-wing economic agenda. First, Pete Peterson's deficit and debt scare campaign and his ongoing effort to gut Social Security and other entitlements. Leading every list of billionaires pushing an issue is billionaire Pete Peterson and his forever war on government. Doing things to make our lives better, especially Social Security, Peterson leads the list because of reports of his pledge to spend $1 billion on his pet issue. Have you ever heard anywhere that the budget deficit and the national debt are a problem? You can't pick up a newspaper or magazine or turn on the radio or TV or listen to any politician from the so-called center to the far right without hearing that. And the reason is Pete Peterson and his money. Peterson and his money are a big part of backing for a Concord Coalition. Fix the debt. The can kicks back. You know, get it? Like, don't kick the can down the road. The can kicks back. The Come Back America Initiative. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. The Moment of Truth Project. The Committee for Economic Development. America Speaks. Plus contributions to many other groups. And just speaking for myself, that's all Pete Peterson. That's how much nonsense, how much bull stuff you can kick up if you're a billionaire. And it doesn't take much effort either when you're a billionaire. It's just a million here, a million there. Remember, there's 1,000 million and a billion. If you're a multi-billionaire, you want to influence policy, well, there's lots of people ready to jump on your piles of cash and take away a little bit of it and come up with this vast program. How many committees and initiatives did I just mention? Well, they're all coming from one person, Pete Peterson. Returning to the print here, unmasking the most influential billionaire in U.S. politics at the L.A. Times. The shame of Washington, this is a quote, comes from the fact that almost every organization promoting the grand fiscal bargain in which those programs will be on the table has accepted somewhere and somehow money from Pete Peterson. SourceWatch Fix the Debt portal contains much more information on this big money influence campaign. Last week, one of Peterson's deficit scare groups was in the news. The Can Kicks Back is an organization named after the narrative that is not cutting Social Security, now is just kicking the can down the road. You've heard that one, right? They claim that this is because there's a generational war where older people are living high on the hog, and younger people will have to pay for this. The group tries to make legislators think younger people want them to cut Social Security using AstroTurf videos and Twitter posts, etc. Well, Peterson's spigot seems to have dried up. The anti-debt group is, wait for it, in debt. All of that AstroTurf hype about younger people demanding Social Security cuts, when the Peterson money ran out, the urgency went away. So again, that's an alternate. Number to call with your comments, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Minimum wage $15.50 or fight. What do you got to say about that, Thomas?
Yeah, well, I think with 4 decades of technological improvement, there might be a little more efficiency so that we could live better than we could back in 19.
Yeah, well, the productivity has been measured and it's way, way up. The economy is bigger. The productivity is up. Who created that productivity? Was it people sitting in executive suites, leaning back in their chair and having a martini?
Well, if we listen to mainstream media, it was the job creator speculators and the entrepreneurs, right? But no, really, I mean, you know, there's this dominant narrative. I think the biggest problem at all is the colonization of the imagination and the mind. Of this false narrative that's promulgated throughout academia of this economic model that is specifically sculpted by those who have a minority of the affluent who have a vested interest in hoodwinking everyone. You know, it's amazing. You think about like the Chicago School of Economics and the Milton Friedman and associated groups promulgating these ridiculous models, and now these models have been adopted by allegedly quote unquote progressive politicians. These ideas about deficit hawking, these ideas about not enough to go around. You know, it's interesting to note if you actually do a comparative study globally of per capita GDP. You know, you look at how much economic per capita money or how much money that a country develops and divided by its citizens. United States itself, on aggregate, generates more money per capita than Switzerland does. And yet, as a contrast, let's go to Switzerland and look. Now, nobody's going to claim that Switzerland is some far, absolute far left socialist bastion. Mm-hmm. You know, Switzerland has almost zero poverty. It's almost entirely a middle class society. It has way more vacation time than the United States.
Yes, I think the fact that we are so rich is very well hidden. And when I say we, I don't mean the 99%.
That's right.
The other day I was taking, actually I got my decimal in the wrong place and embarrassed myself. I've got it right this time, so I'm going to say it right. Just looking at one figure of a few of the tax havens, in other words, the semi-legal hide your money away in the Caymans retreats, banks, $13 trillion in offshore untaxed cash.
Absolutely.
Is sitting around there. If you divide that by the U.S. population, you can give $47,000 to every single man, woman, and baby in the United States. Now, let me ask you, do you have $47,000 sitting around?
No, to be honest, I don't. And I don't know very many people who do. And the ones that I am aware that have that kind of money didn't get it, very honestly, in my view. But, you know, one final comment. I was just listening yesterday on good old KBOO, the Economic Update with Richard Wolff, the left economist who's gotten quite a bit of interest growing now and has very interesting commentaries. But he just mentioned in a relatively new IMF study by two economists, and of course now the IMF is normally associated with a kind of predatory Western exploitation, but every once in a while, in spite of itself, it comes out with some interesting information. Now, evidently there's been an exhaustive recent study by these two economists, Berg and Ostry, about looking into the whole question of whether, let's say, in developing countries, it having a high degree of inequality between the has and the have-nots actually spurs, you know, is actually something that's inevitable consequence of rapid development of the economy.
Of course it doesn't. It bottles up the wealth. And what were those authors that you just quoted? What were the names of those authors?
Berg and Ostry.
Okay.
And evidently this paper is pretty fresh. And the upshot of it is, as I understand it, I haven't read it yet, I'm going to index it and read this paper, is that all of the narrative that assumes that forms of distribution, such as progressive taxation, other forms of taking money and distributing it through society for greater inequality, that the standard narrative has always been, well, that's going to hurt growth. And evidently, across different countries and historically, there is no evidence for it. So let's hope that some of these giant myths that have just been helping the ruling classes and the owner classes hoodwink their populations, that they have to just accept penury. I hope that, you know, this can be one of the pieces that we can use to destroy some.
I really do hope so too, because it's all dependent, you know, getting the Americans to accept austerity and, as you say, penury is it's all dependent on this narrative that, oh, there's not enough money to go around, and that really the reason that you don't have money is because you were not productive enough or didn't get the right degree or any, you know, just any excuse.
That's
the
right.
Fact is, we haven't distributed we haven't distributed money equitably for so long that it's all become sucked up by these scam billionaires who basically gamble with a rigged job with our economy.
Yeah, that's right. How do we ever get out of World War II with the largest budget deficit that we've ever had in the nation's history, with an army of men without jobs who had to come back home and find them?
We got out of that by taxing the rich at 90%.
Right.
90%.
Right. So, there we go. We don't even have to go to Switzerland or anyone else. We can look at our own living memory to see that the lies that we're being told about the lack of money, the lack of wealth in society, are just that, lies.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your call. Yeah, that 90% top tax rate, that was for people who are really quite well off, and that's, you know, 90% that leaves you, 10% that leaves you quite wealthy. That's just tax. Minimum wage, another thing, but when we agree to accept so little that we are, in fact, that we are, in effect, enslaved to our jobs, we hurt everyone. But unfortunately, that's what we've gotten used to. That's why I'm talking about these billionaires. These policies did not appear because people really preferred to work for less. People did not come out into the streets and say, pay us less, pay us less. No, there was manipulation, there was payoffs, and now we have this wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America that we call Congress. Let me talk about another billionaire. His name is John D. Arnold, and his thing is a tax on public employee pensions. Have you heard that the biggest problem facing our states, counties, and cities is the bloated, lavish, insane amount of money that goes to public employee pensions? Of course you have. It's not true, but it's what billionaire John D. Arnold wants you to think. Arnold got his true at Enron trading natural gas derivatives. There's that word, derivatives. Gambling. And after Enron, he used his Enron money to form an energy trading hedge fund. Now he's using his fortune to fund various philanthropic causes, take that word in quotations, including to help Head Start running, help keep Head Start running when Republicans recently shut down the government. That's very nice, unfortunately, but he has also dedicated part of his fortune to gutting public employee pensions because he really hates the idea, and this is just myself speaking here. This guy just really hates the idea that people can survive into old age on the basis of their contracted savings from work. And we live in a historic time in which pensions are simply stolen and recourse against the criminals who steal them is non-existent. As a matter of fact, we have people who gut companies, wipe out pensions, running for president like Mitt Romney. That was his deal. He was part of a vampire fund. In a September report, continuing with the alternate report here, for the Institute for America's Future, the plot against pensions, which has excerpts posted on Salon, David Sirota showed how the Pew Charitable Trust was working in partnership with and funded by John D. Arnold, billionaire. The findings in Sirota's report include conservative activists are manufacturing the perception of a public pension crisis in order to both slash modest retiree benefits and preserve expensive corporate subsidies and tax breaks. Now, let me depart from that text right there. Pensions, and especially as the population ages, the pensions that we have earned that are a part of our compensation. I'm speaking for myself here because I'm a bus driver and I'm working on a pension, and the pension is part of the compensation that is generated by my work over decades, like my fellow bus drivers. That money should be sacred, but of course, the money, the pension funds have been wiped out time and again by corporate buyouts and money shuffling. It's gone to the rich directly, and there's no better way to put it, really. It's just pensions are stolen by the rich these days. And so, to repeat that last sentence that I read, conservative activists are manufacturing the perception of a public pension crisis in order to both slash modest retiree benefits and preserve expensive corporate subsidies and tax breaks. And certainly I see that sort of thing going on right where I work. Here in lovely Portland, Oregon, as a bus driver, the Pew Charitable Trust and the Laura and John Arnold Foundation working together in states across the country to focus the debate over pensions primarily on slashing retiree benefits rather than on raising public revenues. Just another attack on working class, another attempt to make people poor, and generally speaking, billionaires, activist billionaires, I should say, and there's quite a few, really want, they don't just want the money for themselves, they want you to be poor. That's part of the equations. It's super important. It's about the degeneration of their mental processes. When you become a megalomaniac, when you lose track of what's important in life, and you think that money is important in life, and when you set up your own false ego as dependent on how much competitively with other vampires, competitively to see how much you can suck out of the working class and the poor, then you go on this path of evil, and it is evil. And of course, they also suck out the life of the commons, you know, everything from blowing the tops off of mountains to spewing coal dust everywhere. And blowing up whole towns with cheap, dangerous rail cars carrying explosive Bakken oil. The number to call with your comments, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now, returning to the 8-hour day, achieving the 8-hour day with sufficient pay, $15.50 or fight, that is something that will knock back the corporations, because when you've got you know, a generation or two going with people getting enough money. We've seen this in the United States before, to actually send their kids to college. The level of education goes up, the level of confidence goes up, the level of participation in the economy goes up. And that's what the billionaires hate, because, as I was saying, the billionaires have got to see you down, because that's part of the degeneration of their mental process. That's part of their alienation. And it's a sick little compensation that they get, a little schadenfreude, seeing you down. Is there compensation for the fact that they have chosen a life that cannot ever be satisfying? They've chosen the Midas life. They're sick in the head. And we can't expect them to turn around. We're going to have to take that wealth. That's why I keep bringing up that $13 trillion in offshore. That shouldn't be, oh, gee, would you guys kind of like to voluntarily send some of that back? And maybe we could tax it. And, you know, there might be some more taxes down the road, just a little bit. And no, they dodge taxes by hiding the money offshore. All of that should be confiscated. That's where we should be at. Number call 503-231-8187, and James is on the air.
Good morning, Teresa. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I'd like to address a couple of the topics that you were talking about.
Right.
First, the 1550. I think it's a non-issue because the banksters are just going to water down the currency to where you'll have to be paying $10 for a loaf of Dave's Killer Bread instead of $5.
Well, I mean, 1550, as I was saying, I'm basing that on the $2 that Martin Luther King was demanding. That was before productivity went so far up. And throw in the productivity, a little bit of the productivity and all of the inflation, you come up with 1550. So if inflation kills 1550, then make it 550. I don't care. A living wage is what we're going here. And right now, 1550 was pretty close to a living wage.
Well, if that's a short-term solution, then that's fine, you know, but the long-term solution is to get control of the currency.
Well, the long-term solution is right there, and I'm for it, but this is 2014, and so this is a number, this is why it alliterates, okay? That's why I'm saying 1550 instead of 1475. You know, 1475 or fight doesn't work as well, right? 1550, people can imagine that. 1550 or fight.
And I also want to talk about the progressive income tax. I think the progressive income tax administered at community or local level, I think it'd be great. But what happens when it's administered by a central or national authority is they're able to raise the cost of industry for the common man and come in and undercut him and run him out of business, which is what has happened.
That's not what happened in the 1950s when the tax rate was so high. Small businesses were popping up all over the place. People were getting decent wages.
Well, that was how the banksters gained control of our economy. They allowed that. They let that happen. So
I'm sorry, I have to disagree with that narrative. The banksters got control of the economy pretty directly. They paid off Congress, changed the rules, wiped out the Glass-Steagall Act, and just started wiping out people's productivity gains by sucking them up in derivatives gambling.
Well, they actually gained control of the economy when the Federal Reserve was put into place. And then, well, they didn't really have complete control. These are complex issues.
Well, sure, and that's why that's why after the Depression, the Glass-Steagall Act was put into place, so that the sort of speculation, it was the same thing in the 20s, the sort of speculation that crashed the economy in the 20s couldn't be repeated until Clinton signed the Graham-Rudman Act and wiped out the supervision of derivatives gambling. And, you know, I'm overusing the word derivatives. It's just gambling. There was a very similar problem in the 1770s, when George III was spending the treasury, and he did it with gambling.
Yeah. And the 1830s and the 1870s, they were, all those were orchestrated by the banksters. But my main point is, if you, today that they have so much power, if you tax the wealthy, the 99% or 90% or whatever you want to, you know, tax them, all they're going to do is, since they have monopoly on industry, they'll take that and put that into the price of the product, and the price of the product will go up.
Well, now if you're talking about just suggesting this within the Democratic and Republican system and suggesting that it might not go through because there will be dodges this way and that, I think you're absolutely right, and I am calling for a much broader sort of resistance. We saw a hint of it with Occupy, but I think that we are going to have to occupy the banks. We're going to have to do a lot more. We're going to have general strikes, and until we are close to taking power directly, which is what I would certainly prefer, and having democratic elections, which would be a real shock around here.
What I like to do, I can't say on the radio.
Well, all right.
Have a good day, Teresa.
You too. Been talking about the minimum wage and how it affects so many things. When we agree that the minimum is below the amount that is needed to simply have a place to live, and to pay your bills and to have your food and to have your health insurance, I certainly don't accept. You know, I say that I don't like Obamacare. That's not because I don't like an extension of some care to some people. I just think that public health care is part of the commons, is part of our right. We need to look after each other like civilized nations do, who have a national health service. And yes, it's socialized, and they all have to wear little fur hats, and they have to drink borscht every morning and salute the communist flag, and then after that they can have health care, except that I made up that first part. They just have health care, and it doesn't cost nearly as much as the United States, and I'm not in favor of setting up a system in which rich insurance company executives get their money first, no matter what. And the system that we have under Obamacare puts health insurance executives first. That's what it's about. They get paid. And then there's this complicated system. A whole bunch of administrators get paid too, to waste all of this energy and effort when we could simply have a socialized medicine system like Great Britain, like Denmark, like Sweden, like, as I said, a great many civilized countries. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. We need a minimum wage that we can live with that will set the tone, because I don't think everyone should get minimum wage. I just think there should be a bottom, and I think there should be a maximum wage. Because if you don't have a maximum wage, you don't have a chance with democracy. If you have billionaires who are like emperors going about who can set the tone and call the shots on any debate by massively paying off the media, you don't have democracy and you can't have it. You can't have participation on any meaningful level when the tone of the debate has been set by people who can simply seize and maintain control of the means of speaking to each other. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 1550 or a fight. What do you got to say about that, Barry?
Hey, hi, Teresa.
Hi.
You said something about Sirota or something, that billionaire having to do with a Pew Charitable Trust?
Dave Sirota investigated billionaires, and yes, he did expose the fact that the Pew Charitable Trust isn't as neutral as it is often presented. Pew Charitable Trust, I was saying, was working in partnership and funded by John D. Arnold in the attack on public employee pensions. And so the way it works is they work together. The Pew makes it look legitimate. They create all of these little studies that say, oh my God, public employee pensions are too much. Yes. They're too high. They're the problem. And this is just a lie. It's just part of billionaire John D. Arnold's attack to knock down working people.
I have to say something at that. Let's talk about the homeless people now.
All right.
Well, talk about the fox watching the hen house. Pew Charitable Trust is supposed to deal with the homeless, and they're not. I mean, to have this guy head of the Pew Charitable Trust and that they having to do with the homeless, well, this is why nothing is being done.
John D. Arnold does not head the Pew Charitable Trust, but he has worked in concert with them to promote his propaganda.
To promote his propaganda,
yes.
And it's not dealing with the homeless. You see?
It isn't, and it's interesting how well the homelessness situation, the houselessness situation, works as terrorism. I mean, I think about it anytime I think I might lose my job, and I'm sure everyone does. What happens? You know, what's the commons? What's the minimum in the United States? Oh, look, it's right there under that bridge, except that it's not even that, because the cops will come around and kick you out from under the bridge. Absolute terror. And everyone sees it. And the houseless definitely feel that function, not that they want to, but that's how it works. I mean, it's just like white terrorism in the United States. What happens if you're not white enough and you walk in the wrong part of town and you encounter a cop? Well, all kinds of brutal things coming up right up to your death can happen, and that terrorizes people of color.
A kind of constant coercion, huh?
Yeah, and it works great that way. I mean, right now, I mean, I don't want to change topics, but cops are being used, and I could just say that, cops are being used. Cops are being used as the cutting edge of white terrorism in the United States.
Well, okay, and thank you for bringing this up. The Pew Charitable Trust is always introducing themselves as someone that's dealing with the homeless.
Oh, they're neutral, yes. They're just, you know, they're out here to help you. And just trying to look at the best and most logical way to yada, yada, yada. No, they're in with the rich people. These are rich people. There's another name that you should remember, by the way. If you're thinking of nice charitable organizations that are in every town, one of them is the Junior League. Now, these are women. But you will always find that the Junior League is tied in with the biggest power, the biggest money in every town. And they will knock down any attempt to provide housing in common.
My gosh. Okay, well, thank you for the insight. Thank you, Teresa.
You're welcome. Let's bring up another billionaire, Charles Munger, a near billionaire and son of a billionaire. He bankrolled California's Proposition 20 in 2010 to create a citizens' redistricting committee that took the process of drawing political districts out of the hands of California's politicians. They believe that Munger and many Republicans believe this would immediately turn the state over to the Republicans because the districts were gerrymandered, and the Proposition 20 passed because they can control media and say it's about anything, right? But it didn't work out the way Munger and Republicans had hoped, not by a long shot. The earlier Democratic gerrymandering process had been too clever by half. To make sure Democrats would have a guaranteed majority in the legislature, they drew up districts in a way that moved Republican voters into a minority of safe Republican districts. The problem with this is that it takes a two-thirds vote in the legislature to pass a budget, and Democrats had rigged the system in a way that left the Republicans with just over one-third control. So year after year, Republicans blocked everything, demanding big tax breaks for corporations, because they're just not rich enough, as a ransom for passing everything that helped any actual people. And, you know, that's a billionaire messing with politics directly. We've seen this recently, and I remember everyone was outraged, and I want to keep bringing it up because I don't want you to forget that the Oregon legislature had a special session to kiss Nike's